Out front next, the breaking news, Trump employee number 5 breaking his silence, and we'll hear from the man who is a key witness in the Mar-a-Lago classified documents investigation tonight. Hear what he has to say about moving Trump's boxes of classified documents. Plus, he is a software engineer hired by Trump's campaign to find voter fraud, and he found none. We'll give you all the details tonight as he's warning this evening Trump will try to overturn the election again if he doesn't win. He'll be my guest this hour. And a passenger on that terrifying flight that plummeted midair, speaking out. He says bodies were flying everywhere, hitting the ceiling, leaving blood like a scene from The Exorcist. Let's go out front. And good evening, I'm Erin Burnett. Out front tonight, we begin with the breaking news, Trump's employee number 5 speaking out. The man who has only been known as Trump employee number 5 in the classified documents indictment from Jack Smith, revealing his identity, explaining for the first time how he helped move classified documents for Trump. His name is Brian Butler, a longtime chauffeur to Trump's family. Now, Butler spent about 20 years working for Trump, and he claims it was on June 3rd, 2022, when Trump's personal aide, Walt Nauta, the name may be familiar, asked him if he could borrow Butler's SUV to move luggage from Mar-a-Lago to the former president's personal plane. Now, that date is the same date that Trump's attorneys met with the FBI, touring a basement storage room to look for documents. It's the same day they signed a document saying they'd hunted for additional papers and found few. And Butler telling Caitlin Collins that the luggage he moved included the white banker's boxes in Jack Smith's indictment.
They were the boxes that were in the indictment, the white banker's boxes. That's what I remember loading.
And did you have any time, any idea at the time that there was potentially U.S. national security secrets in those boxes?
No clue. No, I had no clue. I mean, we were just taking them out of the Escalade, piling them up. I remember they were all stacked on top of each other, and then we're lifting them up to the pilots.
Now, Butler says he debated going public for months and only recently decided to speak out because he believes that voters should hear the truth about his former boss and the case before the November election. And Butler's role in all of this didn't end there. He was also involved in conversations about allegedly trying to destroy evidence of a crime at Mar-a-Lago. According to Jack Smith's indictment, Mar-a-Lago property manager Carlos de Oliveira also told Trump employee number 5, which, of course, we now know as Brian Butler, that Nauta wanted de Oliveira to talk to Trump employee number 4 to see how long camera footage was stored. And we have a lot to get to tonight. I want to get to Caitlin Polance, who has been working on this story with her sources to help break it. She's out front live near Mar-a-Lago. And Caitlin, what more are you learning from Butler?
Well, Erin, it is quite clear from what Brian Butler has to say publicly now, and also what he spoke to prosecutors about many times, is that he is a window, a witness to the alleged obstruction, the allegations against Donald Trump, Walt Nauta, and Carlos de Oliveira, that there was a cover-up for Trump because Trump did not want to give those classified documents back to the federal government. That is no more apparent. It's so obviously apparent in the indictment, in that he's listed as Trump employee 5. And then he's also, in speaking to Caitlin Collins, able to say about how he had this longtime friendship with Carlos de Oliveira, the third person who is a defendant with Trump, and that friendship broke down. The very last line in the indictment against all three of these men, including Donald Trump, when prosecutors are describing what happened there, is they describe a moment where Brian Butler was with Carlos de Oliveira and gets outreach from the other co-defendant, Walt Nauta, asking Brian Butler, is Carlos loyal? Is he going to remain loyal to Trump? Butler assures him, yes, he will. This is my friend. He doesn't want to do anything to hurt his relationship with Donald Trump. And then Trump calls Carlos de Oliveira directly. Butler, in his conversation with Caitlin Collins earlier today, described that taking place on a trip, a birthday celebration that he was having with his dear friend, Carlos de Oliveira, when that call came in from Donald Trump. Here's a little more of what he said.
You know, he takes the call. We're standing in the food court. I think we went to sit down, and I can't remember how long the conversation was, but I know at the end of the conversation when they hung up, Carlos said, he's going to get me an attorney.
Did he tell you anything else that Trump said to him?
I didn't ask, and I don't remember him saying anything else, but, you know, I was just told not that long, not, you know, too long before. We're getting him an attorney by Walt, and then he gets the call that he's going to get him the attorney.
Aaron, so that's the last line in the narrative of the indictment, but the beginning of the end of the friendship of Carlos de Oliveira and Brian Butler. Now they do not speak anymore. Carlos de Oliveira is charged with making a false statement to the FBI, is headed to trial alongside Donald Trump. Brian Butler is here speaking publicly and not using, notably, an attorney within the Trump legal universe. Aaron?
All right. Caitlin, thank you very much. And I want to go now to Ryan Goodman, our legal analyst, Stephanie Grisham, the former Trump White House press secretary, and David Axelrod, of course, the former senior advisor to President Obama. So, Ryan, Butler, a 20-year employee of the Trumps, right, who knows the habits, knows the proclivities, knows what moves when, coming out and talking about all these boxes. How important is the information that he is providing in this case?
It seems to be incredibly important. He's a direct witness and participant in a large part of the activities that are indicted. Mm-hmm. And so he's there when they're talking about information that would be about deleting the video footage that to hide it from the FBI and the grand jury, as alleged in the indictment. He's there when they are loading Trump's plane with the boxes before the FBI arrives at Mar-a-Lago same day to find and to collect the documents. That's huge. And he has no axe to grind. He seems to have had a good relationship with the Trump organization, with Trump himself for 20 years, and his best friends with one of the other co-defendants. So it seems to be that he's just telling the truths that he has, and that could be very powerful.
And David, you know, Butler told CNN that he's speaking publicly now because he believes voters should hear the truth before the November election. Obviously, the way that this case is moving right now, from a legal perspective, it would appear very unlikely that we get that decision before the election that we know. So it may only be in just more snippets if individuals choose to speak out. Do you think this makes a difference to voters?
Look, I think at the margins, maybe. I think that people who are paying attention to it will. But, you know, a couple of things about this. One is, there's a reason why the president and his lawyers are working so hard to delay these trials. They're trying to push them off past November because they understand that particularly this case, the facts are very, very clear. Yeah. Convictions would be damaging in a race that is marginal and could cost them the election. So they're pushing this off. The second thing is tomorrow we have the Hur hearings. And those are, I think, one of the reasons that the Republicans are leaning so hard into all of this isn't just to talk about the question of age that Hur raised, but they want to muddy the waters. And you can see on social media, it's like, you know, in reaction to this story, people saying, you know, the Biden did it, Trump did it, Trump gets indicted. That's his narrative. So I'm not sure that this alone will influence events. If this thing goes to trial, his testimony sure could.
Right. It is important, as you note, though, that Hur, which is the Biden classified documents handling special counsel, that is going to be tomorrow. Stephanie, let me play another exchange, though, that Butler had with Caitlin. Listen to this.
Did you ever think to yourself, why were there so many boxes at Mar-a-Lago?
For me, I'm just thinking, the former president, he has a lot of stuff he likes to lug around with him.
And, you know, Stephanie, I see you sort of smiling. I mean, you know the lay of the land around Trump. Does that sort of ring true to you? I mean, was this a constant sort of shifting and moving of boxes like this?
You know, absolutely. I felt that a lot of what he said rang true, and the boxes was certainly one of them. I mean, all throughout our time at the White House, he would have his boxes. There were those brown boxes, but if we didn't get these specific boxes on every plane, on every Air Force One, on Marine One, there would be hell to pay. So he did like his boxes. Now, there were only two or three of them, and they were newspaper clippings. It was not, you know, 10 to 15 boxes, as Brian has said. You know, another thing I want to say is that, you know, the mob mentality really rang true to me. He called him the boss, which is what we all called him. There were the loyalty tests. Again, I mean, that happened to all of us, these loyalty tests. And then lastly, I'll just say this guy's got nothing to gain right now. I can say, as somebody who was with them all the time for 6 years and who has spoken out as well, he's going to get attacked by the right. He's going to become, you know, a disgruntled lower level employee. And he's lost really good lifelong friends, which is something I can completely sympathize with. So I think that's something for people to kind of think through, is that he's not gaining anything from doing this.
Ryan, you're nodding.
Oh. So I completely agree. I think that it makes complete sense as to why he would come out now publicly, because it does look like it's never going to go to trial. And he does want to explain to people why, in his view, this is not a witch hunt. It's real. And just to go back to something David said, I do think tomorrow we're going to hear from the special counsel Hur in the hearings at the House side about his report on Biden's handling of classified documents. But it is important to remember that in Hur's report, he actually says that the Trump case is much worse than Biden. And he actually says things that now we have Mr. Butler talking about, the ways in which Trump tried to hide the documents from the government, putting him on a plane instead, and trying to delete footage. There's nothing like that in the Hur report.
Right. No, I mean, the deleting footage aspect of this and that separate, that all of that still sort of defies the imagination, although I know not your imagination, Stephanie. I mean, all of this, even the phone call that you heard Butler just talking about on vacation together, and Trump calls and offers to get him a lawyer, that also rings true to you.
Absolutely. Again, it's kind of this mob bunker mentality that we will pay for your lawyer. We will take care of you. You stick with us and no one can touch you. So again, this guy, I assume, is, you know, paying for his own attorney, or maybe his attorney's doing it in kind. But it's scary, and it costs you a lot of money to speak out.
And speaking of a lot of money, David, there's less of it, not so much, at the RNC, because it comes all of these developments as Trump's having trouble fundraising. We've just found out that the RNC is doing mass layoffs, cutting vendor contracts, and that this is in a much greater sense than would happen with a normal change in leadership at the RNC, which they are going through, of course, with Trump's daughter-in-law now running it. As someone who's been on the front line of a campaign, how serious could this funds issue be?
I think very. I mean, money is very, very important in campaigns. It's how, you need that money to pay for organization. You need that money to get your message out. I would expect that some of these organizations supporting the president, as well as the president's campaign, are going to start a sustained attack on Trump in the next several weeks, certainly within months. And he doesn't have the air defenses now to respond to that. So it is a big deal that they don't have money. And I'm sure one of the reasons they're making all these cuts is to try and divert as much money as they can to the operations in the states, which are starving, and to media.
All right. Thank you all very much. I appreciate it. And next, a stark warning from the man the Trump campaign hired to find election fraud. That was his job, to show them all of the fraud, to show the country. And he did. He looked and looked and looked, and he found nothing. But he does say he knows what Trump will do if he loses again. He's my guest next. Plus, a rare sighting of Kate Middleton after admitting that her first post-surgery family photo was doctored. And now the royals are resisting calls to release the original unedited photo. How come? And we have some new images just into out front. We've gotten these pictures from inside the Boeing jet after it took that sudden nosedive over the ocean. Dozens injured, and a passenger who was on that plane says bodies were flying everywhere. And you spoke to the pilot. He's my guest.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support. Your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life wherever you get your podcasts.
Tonight, Trump will do it again. A stark warning tonight that the former president will dispute the election results if he loses in November. And this is from somebody who would know. His name is Ken Block, software engineer paid by the Trump campaign in 2020. And he was paid to investigate multiple claims of election fraud. For example, like if dead people voting impacted the election. Ken looked. He did not find proof of that. Same thing for non-citizens voting in the election. Also, voters who voted in two states or voters who voted twice in the same state. Mail ballots being requested fraudulently. Every single thing that you may have heard of over these years, every single one of them, Ken Block looked into, ran down, and found no proof that any impacted the election. And Ken is now out front. He is the author of the brand new book, Disproven, My Unbiased Search for Voter Fraud for the Trump Campaign, the data that shows why he lost and how we can improve our elections. And Ken, you and I have been speaking over the past year privately, and also you've been on the show before. But the bottom line of all of this, I was just listing through, dead people, two states, ballots. You looked into all of it.
We looked in the swing states in particular. We looked at every registered voter to determine who was deceased and who wasn't. We looked as best as we could for every mail ballot cast in the 2020 election that included the swing states to see if we could find evidence that those voters also voted in another state. We found small amounts of that fraud. We found nothing that rose to the level of being able to change an election result. And it's really important that people understand that although there was some fraud, it wasn't enough. And the claims of voter fraud that we're hearing just don't have a foundation in truth.
All right, so let's go through just a few of them. So that you're going overall and you looked into all of those. But let's delve into a couple of them. Wisconsin, for example. Eric Trump emails a lawyer from the Trump campaign who had hired you. His name happens to be Alex Cannon. So Eric Trump emails him in early December of 2020. Can you look into a claim that more than 700,000 people voted twice in Wisconsin? And that is, can we just stop for a second? 700,000 people voting twice in one state. That was the claim. Next morning, Cannon forwards it to you. Hey, Ken, your problem. Can you look into this? It only took you a few hours
Correct.
To shoot this one down. But you call this by far the wildest of all the claims that
yeah.
you looked at. How'd they react when you told them within hours that this was a bunch of BS?
Well, this was near the end of a month of doing this sort of thing. And when Cannon called me to tell me about the specifics of this, when he asked me to look at it, he told me, he said, Ken, tell me why this is wrong. And so he knew that this wasn't going to be true. And what had happened was some people got really excited. They misinterpreted the data they looked at, came up with a wild finding, wanted the Department of Justice to come in and, I guess, and start arresting people in Wisconsin. And the reality was they misinterpreted the information. It went from the people who did the analysis to a golfer, to the manager of a Trump golf course, to Eric Trump, to Alex Cannon, to me. And that's just the insanity that was happening at the time.
Okay, so the birthday problem.
The birthday
this
problem.
Is another one, another fraud claim. So John Eastman, who obviously was at the center of the fake elector scheme, he claimed more than 16,000 people in Nevada voted in Nevada and in another state. And his evidence was that they had the same name and the same birthday. So that's why they voted in two different states. You look into that and you find?
Yeah, so there's a well-known problem that hospitals struggle with. Big hospitals have the same problem you do when looking at voter data. It's not impossible for two people to share the same name and the exact same date of birth. You get a large enough group of people together, that happens, because how many John Smiths do you know, right? I mean, we have some really common names in this country, and what people frequently, the mistake they made when looking at voter data and trying to match up the information in voter data, they will look at the name and the date of birth and go, oh, we have a match, but that match is wrong 90% of the time.
That is incredible. Yeah. Just for people to realize that,
yeah.
right? That statistically that can happen, because you can hear it and say that does sound wrong. But then the statistics, of course, are reality.
Yeah.
You mentioned at the outset of this conversation, though, that there was fraud. Just it was de minimis. It wasn't enough to turn the election. Okay, we all know that. That's a fact. However, nobody wants any fraud. And I know you do believe that there are ways to improve elections.
Absolutely.
That you would think the Democrats and Republicans could agree on, like what?
Yeah. So I'm going to give you some information that will kind of blow your mind. In the state of New York, hundreds of people voted in 2020 whose date of birth was either 1800, 1850, or 1900, all of which are impossible. They're impossibly old. In New Jersey, there were thousands like that. In New York State, there are thousands with those birthdays that are just registered. In New Jersey, there are tens of thousands. New York has a bigger problem. There are millions of voters who voted in 2020 that the state can't identify because they don't have social security numbers or driver's licenses for those voters. These are problems that other states don't have. States like Nevada and Georgia have excellent quality voter data. New Jersey and New York don't. They can, but they have to make the effort to clean things up. So these are the things that I think we really need to get to the bottom of, and it's an important conversation for us to have in this country.
Well, it certainly is, because I think we can all agree that HGH hasn't gotten us to the point where someone born in 1800 would still be alive.
Correct.
All right, thank you very much, Ken. I appreciate it, and hope everyone will read this in full, because I know you go through so many of the detailed examples.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And next, breaking news, a new U.S. intelligence assessment tonight, finding the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's viability as a leader may be in jeopardy. The former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett will be with me to respond. Plus, a rare apology from the royal family after Princess Kate, who has not been seen in months, takes responsibility for releasing a doctored family photo. So what is going on? Breaking news, a new U.S. intelligence assessment finds that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's viability, that's the word used, as a leader, quote, may be in jeopardy. The report says, and I quote, distrust of Netanyahu's ability to rule has deepened and broadened across the public from its already high levels before the war, and we expect large protests demanding his resignation and new elections. This comes as a Palestinian aid worker tells out front about the dire situation on the ground in Gaza. We received this latest audio message from Mahmoud Shalabi, who we have been speaking to regularly since the start of the war.
There is no food to sell. I have seen a man in the market buying, a very crappy type of crisp and giving it to his two children. And I remember him saying, this is for your breakfast and lunch. So make sure you calculate your portions properly, because I have nothing left and this is your food for the day.
Clarissa Ward is out front live from Jerusalem. And Clarissa, what more can you tell us about what's happening inside Gaza tonight?
Well, we heard today, Aaron, from Cindy McCain, the director of the World Food Program, and she warned that famine is, quote, imminent in northern Gaza if the amount of aid getting in does not increase exponentially. She went on to say that there would need to be 300 trucks a day going into Gaza in order to begin to meet the needs of the people. And just to give you a sense of what the figures are, yesterday 225 trucks successfully entered Gaza. Today, though, just 149 trucks entered Gaza. And a big part of the problem here, Aaron, is that even the ones that do go into Gaza are having real trouble getting into northern Gaza. She had also mentioned, she said that airdrops are not practical, that road is the best way to get things in. She also mentioned ships. We had been waiting for a ship to leave Cyprus, was supposed to leave yesterday with UAE aid on board. The Cyprus Coast Guard coming out and saying that has been delayed for practical reasons. It should happen soon. But really, can't underscore enough, Aaron, that time is really running out for the people of Gaza. Just today we heard from Gaza's health authorities that another two children died as a result of acute malnutrition and dehydration at the Kamal Adwan Hospital that services northern Gaza, Aaron.
Clarissa, there have been hopes of a ceasefire, that there would be a ceasefire reached with the beginning of Ramadan. Where does that stand?
Those hopes seem to have largely faded. Talks are continuing, but we saw last night, which was the first night of Ramadan, more than 60 people were killed inside Gaza in strikes, according to Gaza's health ministry. That continues throughout the day. The real concern, of course, Aaron, is what happens with Rafah. If you remember, this had been what Biden, President Biden called a red line. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu doubling down in an interview today, saying that he would go ahead with the operation. But U.S. intelligence seems to be that it does not appear that that would be imminent. They haven't seen the sort of movements on the ground that they would expect to see to indicate that such a thing would be imminent, Aaron.
Clarissa, thank you very much. Live from Israel tonight. And out front now, the former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. And Prime Minister, I appreciate your time tonight. It's good to see you again. I know you're here just for another day or so before you're back in Israel. The U.S. Intelligence Committee assessment, which I just shared a moment ago, says that Netanyahu's viability as a leader may be in jeopardy, that massive protests, even more massive than prior, demanding his resignation are expected. Do you agree with the U.S. intelligence assessment?
Well, I think, you know, Israel's a vibrant democracy, and it's no secret that there's massive unrest in Israel vis-a-vis the political situation. But I also have to say in the same token that overwhelming majority of Israelis support the goal, and the goal is to destroy Hamas, because we really don't have any choice. And in terms of Rafah, also an overwhelming majority, almost every Israeli understands that we have to take Rafah if we want Hamas to go away. And as I said, knowing that Hamas is telling us that they're going to attack us again and again and again, we really have no choice.
Of course, their ability to attack you has been dramatically changed. Hamas now is not Hamas before October 7th.
Yes, but if we don't destroy them fully, they'll reconstitute themselves.
Okay. Nonetheless,
you can't leave a bit of Hamas, so then we'll see Hamas rebuild itself, rearm itself, and we'll meet them another 2 years down the road. That's something that Israel tried for 17 years. It failed.
This does come down to Rafah, as you said, though, right now, in terms of the U.S. relationship. And Biden has said that it's a red line if Israel does go in with an assault in Rafah, something that, at least at this point, the Israelis appear to be going ahead with or saying they're going to do it in their own terms. In fact, when you listen to Biden and you listen to Netanyahu, they both have a red line in the opposite way on the exact same thing. Here they are.
Would invasion of Rafah, which you have urged him not to do, would that be a red line?
It is a red line, but I'm never going to leave Israel.
You know, I have a red line. You know what the red line is? That October 7th doesn't happen again. Never happens again.
That's public. They're both very frustrated with each other, and it's very open. I mean, you heard President Biden after the State of the Union, right? He wasn't even upset to be overheard criticizing Prime Minister Netanyahu. How deep do you think the rift is between them right now?
Well, you know, always there's personal issues and stuff like that, but I think that we can resolve this by achieving two goals. One is to destroy Hamas, and the second is to ensure that the 1 million Gaza citizens that are in Rafah are moved from Rafah before we take Rafah. So if we do those two things, I think both those the leaders
can
do it.
Realistically, where do you move
to them? The area north of Khan Yunis? There's a fairly big area where we can allow them to be for the meantime. Look, it's not a 5-star hotel. It's not pleasant there. Nothing here is something that we wanted to do. This is a big problem. We didn't choose our neighbors to be Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah. I wish our neighbors were Vermont and Connecticut, but they aren't. And we got to deal with it. And no one's going to do it for us. And I think
wouldn't you go after Sinwar and the other leaders of Hamas one by one at a time and place of your choosing, much like the United States did with Osama bin Laden, as opposed to continuing to have an assault in which innocent people are dying every single day?
Well, because it's not about only Sinwar. Even if you take out Sinwar, you still have this organization called Hamas, and we have to dismantle the organization so it doesn't rebuild itself.
And you still think it's a strong enough deep enough organization after everything you've done to reconstitute itself as it was before?
Yes. You need to reach a critical mass of surrender and destruction of Hamas in order for it not to be able to rebuild.
Politico is reporting that Biden is so upset by the issue in Rafah that he may condition military aid to Israel. So specifically, that if Israel moves forward with a large-scale invasion of Rafah, that the United States could withhold military assistance and weaponry to Israel. Now, obviously, over history, Israel is by far the single largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid in history. Council on Foreign Relations has it about $300 billion, adjusted for inflation. Do you believe that? Is that a real threat? Do you think he would actually make good on that?
I hope not, because we're fighting your war, Aaron. We're fighting the war against radical Islam. Hamas is not about peace. It's not about the Palestinians. It's about radical Islam, the forefront of radical Islam. And mark my words, if we are prevented from defeating radical Islam in Gaza, you're going to meet radical Islam again here in New York. You're going to meet it in London, on the streets. You're going to meet it across the world. Every Islamic radical terrorist is looking at what's going on in Gaza, and that's their litmus test. Do we have the resolve? And we knew it's going to be tough. We knew that. But you can't stop in the middle just because it's tough. You know, I want to tell you something. When Japan attacked America and killed 2,400 Americans at Pearl Harbor, America took time, took 4 years. 3 million Japanese died in war. But you knew
and
that
America
you had
did some
to
shameful
do that.
Things.
I don't think
like camps for Japanese people.
I think perhaps America was imperfect, but America was darn good in fighting and defeating the total evil that Japan and Nazi Germany presented back then. We're fighting total evil. And we might be imperfect, but we're doing everyone's job. And the world should back Israel. Otherwise, everyone's going to face it. These zombie murderers are going to come right over here.
So what you call a zombie murderers, obviously others see a different way. Maybe not about Hamas specifically, but they see this as
Hamas.
A broader issue. Jonathan Glazer, the filmmaker, Jewish director who won an Oscar last night for his Holocaust film, The Zone of Interest, used his acceptance speech, as I know you may be aware, to condemn Israel's actions at this point in the war. Here's what he said.
Our film shows where dehumanization leads at its worst. It shaped all of our past and present. Right now, we stand here as men who refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict for so many innocent people. Whether the victims of October... whether the victims of October the 7th in Israel or the ongoing attack on Gaza, all are victims of this dehumanization. How do we resist?
We stand here as men who refute their Jewishness on the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation, and then the applause. Your response to that?
It's shameful. He thinks he's distancing himself from Israel and somehow he'll be loved. You know, Jews have tried the approach of being murdered again and again and hoping for sympathy. That's not something that I believe in. I think that we need to be strong. We need to be proud. We're on the right. Nobody in Israel wanted this. No one wanted it. We were on our festival in Israel, and on that morning, I remember it just like right now, that morning at 6:30 in the morning when Hamas attacked and murdered and raped our women and kidnapped our kids and burnt entire families. So who's he kissing up to? You think you're going to be more popular because you get some clapping there? Stand up for your nation. Stand up for the right. And you know what? This is not only about Jews. It's about right and wrong. And I have moral clarity. They are in the wrong. We're in the right. Stand behind us.
All right, Prime Minister Bennett, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And next, conspiracy theories like this one surrounding this picture are running rampant after Princess Kate admits she doctored a family photo. So why won't the royal family just release the original picture? Plus, a Boeing 787 suddenly plunging in a nosedive, people flying through the cabin, blood on the ceiling. I'm going to speak to a passenger who was on board that jet, says it looked like a scene from The Exorcist.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Tonight, a rare sighting of Princess Kate pictured in a car alongside her husband, Prince William. Kensington Palace says she was headed to a private appointment. It came just hours after news agencies took what is an extraordinary step. They recalled this photo after determining that it had been manipulated. Well, then eventually, Princess Kate came out and said she did the manipulation herself, all of which has raised more questions about why she is still staying out of the public eye after her abdominal surgery 2 months ago. Richard Quest is out front.
It was the picture that was meant to put to rest worries about Kate.
This photo of the Princess of Wales and her children has now been pulled from circulation.
Only hours after the photo was released on Mother's Day in the UK, the Associated Press news agency was the first to withdraw it, using what they call a kill notification. The AP said, at closer inspection, it appears that the source has manipulated the image. By source, they mean the princess. The problem is Princess Charlotte's sleeve isn't where it should be.
We have experts, Photoshop experts, like the guys sitting behind me, that it doesn't take a second for them to see that the image was altered and manipulated.
And her hair ends abruptly. The zipper on Kate's sweater is misaligned. The other big agencies, Reuters and AFP, were quick to issue their own kill notices, telling news outlets not to use the image. Then, more than 24 hours after she posted it, the Princess of Wales apologised, saying, like many amateur photographers, I do occasionally experiment with editing. At one level, this is nothing more than an amateur photographer getting it wrong. But the underlying issue is the fact that the Princess of Wales has not been seen since having unspecified abdominal surgery back in January. This grainy photograph taken on Monday as Kate travelled to a private appointment with William is one of the few images that surfaced since then. We don't know what editing she did, and the palace haven't released the unedited version. So is this just an amateur photographer's learning experience? Or is there something more to the picture that's fueled 1,000 words of speculation?
So, Richard, yeah. Such a thing should not spark so much conversation. But in light of the fact that nobody's seen her and nobody knows what happened to her and nobody knows what she went through, there's such intense interest. So if there is nothing wrong other than just a bad edit job, why not just put out the original unedited photo?
Oh, absolutely.
Or one of them. I'm sure there were many taken.
Right, and you would have a benefit because she could then say, I'm just like you. I'm an amateur photographer. I did this, and this is what it looked like originally, and this is what I tried to do, and it all went horribly wrong. You see, the real problem with this picture is it was cack-handed. I mean, this was so badly done that... Yeah. So let's say she does it, and then it has to go to Kensington Palace Media Department, Press Department, who then release it as an official news photo. I mean, and nobody checked it, and nobody looked at it to see, is it conspiracy or is it cock-up? That's what this comes to.
And so then the conspiracy theories fill that question mark, sure. Right? Fill that space, like the Vogue cover, right? Where they put a Vogue cover she did a few years ago, and they just take a six-second time lapse, they can go look at it themselves, and they say, oh, now it's her 2 years ago, because they're worried of, well, we haven't seen her. Yeah. We don't
know. The point here is the onus is now on the palace. They put out a crappy photo, which they then had to withdraw and then had to explain. And it is their onus to explain why. That's the point. Yeah. I actually probably think she did do it herself. I mean, she's an amateur photographer. She probably did have a go at it. What I want to know is why nobody senior up the chain in the palace didn't say, right. Hang on.
Right. Either didn't notice, why they didn't notice it, or why they didn't say something about it. All right. Richard, thank you. And next, a packed Boeing jet nosedives without notice. People were flying throughout the cabin. Tonight, a passenger who was on that jet tells us the pilot's chilling description of what went wrong. Tonight, nosedive. Growing questions about what caused a plane carrying 263 passengers to suddenly plummet midair, sending bodies flying through the cabin, hitting the plane's ceiling. The airline calling it a, quote, technical error, but no further explanation has been given. It was a Boeing 787. At least 50 people were hurt in the incident, and the flight was from Sydney to Auckland in New Zealand. My next guest is Brian Jokat. He was on that plane, and he shared these photos with us. So in the pictures here that you're seeing for the first time, you can see the force of the jolt was so strong. The paneling above the stowage compartment, right above your seat where you would put bags, is broken. And it was broken by bodies, by people who were hurled out of their seats. And then Brian had a conversation with the pilot after the incident. He came back in the plane, and he's going to tell you about it because Brian is out front with me now. And Brian, I appreciate your time. Thank God you're okay physically. I can only imagine the trauma. I mean, it's a terrifying incident. Can you describe to me exactly what happened? You know, you're flying along. I think in your case, you dozed off. And then what?
Yeah, thank you. It was like a scene out of a movie when actually you're actually in the movie. I had dozed off and luckily had my seatbelt engaged. And the next thing you know, the plane, as I've kind of learned to understand, dropped something to the effect of 500 feet instantly, and then had the effect of it coming like a roller coaster and then started to point down. And that's when and I opened my eyes and there was various individuals at the top of the plane just stuck to the roof, and then they fell to the floor. And then I just realized I'm not in a movie. This is actually for real and not dreaming. This is for real.
So when you're dreaming and it feels like a nosedive, there's a moment where you think maybe it is a dream, but you wake up to see hitting the ceiling.
Yeah, and I looked next to me, and the guy was out of his seat and on the ceiling of the plane, and then he fell and hurt himself pretty bad, and then people were screaming and crying, and yeah, it was mass chaos for a few short seconds.
And there was a moment in your head where you thought, "Oh my God, now this is it. I'm going to die."
Yeah, there was clearly a moment in my head. And then I just kind of resigned to the fact that this could be it. You know, this might be it. And and then the announcement came on, take your seats, please, anyone. You know, we'll be sending help as quickly as possible. There's any doctors on board, and a few doctors stepped up to the plate and started to give assistance and mend some people up that were bleeding and had various kind of injuries, putting some neck braces on people. It was touch and go.
Oh, so the pilot, after this happens, comes back to check on everybody after the incident, so, comes over to where you are. Brian, how did he look?
I think he was in shock. Just, I think he felt that he wanted to see what people were going through. He walked to the back, and I immediately engaged with him and said, you know, what was that? And he openly admitted, he said, I lost control of the plane. My gauges just kind of went blank on me. And that's when the plane just took a dive.
So literally, he says the gauges went blank.
Yeah, he said they malfunctioned.
Mm-hmm. And did he say that made it so he didn't have the ability then to even control it, to fly it?
He said for that brief moment he couldn't control anything, and that's when the plane just did what it did. And then he said the gauges came back and then re-engaged, and the plane just re-engaged to its normal flight pattern. And we had no issues before, no issues after, but just that moment.
I mean,
it was quite surreal.
That is terrifying. Can I ask you what it was like after this happened and the plane flies again, and obviously the pilots are in the front and you're all back there? was it silent? What were those last 45 minutes like?
There was 25 minutes of eerily silence from the ones that were okay. And then a lot of, you could hear people sobbing and a lot of people kind of in pain with, you know, kind of, yeah, just kind of hunched over and people shaking, like they were, their hands were shaking, and it was bizarre. It was, I have to say, it was, and seeing those people flying around, it was like a scene out of The Exorcist. I was like, what is this? You know, it was hard to believe that to see that happen firsthand.
Well, Brian, thank you very much for sharing it with us. Of course, so sorry for you and everyone on board that plane. It is terrifying what happened, terrifying what the pilot told you, and we all want some answers, and obviously you and your fellow passengers deserve them as quickly as possible. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
And thanks so much to all of you for being with us. AC360 starts now.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.